Hello and welcome to Series 2 of The Heart of Teaching. My name is Aoife Lynham. I'm a teacher educator and researcher in Hibernia College, and today I'm delighted to speak to artist and writer Jackie Mars. From the age of 6, Jackie wanted to be an artist. Her very first children's book was Joe's Storm, and since then, she has authored and illustrated many, many more. I came across Jackie first as an illustrator when my son was given a beautiful gift of The Lost Spells. There is something incredibly magical and captivating about Jackie's work, so I went in search of more. I bought Mrs. Noah's Pockets and Mrs. Noah's Garden, which were written by Jackie, and now I'm hooked. I'm over the moon today to talk to Jackie about her books and how we can use them in the classroom. I hope you enjoy. Brilliant. Thank you, Jackie, so much for being here. I think I've told you already that I'm going to try my best not to fangirl too much throughout this interview and gush too much because I am very excited to have you here. It's a little bit of magic in my day, definitely. So I suppose, could you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, well, how old am I now? 59 years old. I've spent my life drawing and colouring in, writing stories. I live in a small house by the sea. When I was a child, all I wanted to do was draw and dream. And I used to get told off for doing that at school. But now I love going into schools and saying I get paid to do both of these things. because that's kind of what my work is, really. It's the main part of my work is done when I'm sitting on the hill watching birds and clouds and letting things slide into the mind's eye. Basically, I'm just a woman who likes colouring in and writing stories and reading.
Writing magical stories. So you've talked about how you're inspired. Was there someone there, like was there a teacher or anyone along the way that kind of encouraged you and your talents?
I was very lucky because we didn't have many books at home. And I didn't have much guidance with reading or art. I didn't come from a family who went to art galleries and things like that. But I had two teachers who were history teachers. So Mr. Creer and Mr. Eady. And what they did was, they weren't art teachers, but Mr. Creer in particular loved photography. He loved art. And he showed me some of his collection of books that he had at home. He taught me how to think for myself. And I think it is, you know, there's two sides to education. The side that I couldn't get on with was the learning of facts, the doing exams and things like that. The side that I really had such a hunger for was looking at things and then thinking about them for myself. And that's what he taught me. And that, I think, has stood me in good stead for most of my life, and I think it will continue to. So not taking as given what you're told. Mm-hmm. The opposite of, I guess, what you get at the moment is so much emphasis on learning, reading and testing. Mm-hmm. That's the bit that I was rubbish at. And also, I think all that does is test whether you've got a good memory. Mr. Creer and Mr. Eady, who turned up at one of my events once.
Did they? Oh, wonderful.
I got to say thank you in person.
Oh, that's lovely. And I think, I think that's a lovely message that you've given there about how important it is for teachers not to be stuck on the textbooks, not to be stuck mm-hmm. on the standardized testing, and to kind of let our pupils become little scientists and little explorers and kind of make sure that they're encouraged to do that. Because if you look at how successful you are now, you know, it's so important that children don't feel, especially with exams and things like mm-hmm. that. I used to hate exams, but get me to sit down and do a research dissertation and I'm in my element. You know, so everyone has their own way. And I always say any lectures that I'm giving, I always kind of preface it with, I'm a visual learner. So there's going to be lots of visuals here. There's going to be videos. There's going to be different ways rather than just the text, because I can't. It doesn't go into my brain. I need different kind of formats. And it's interesting, actually. I've seen you doing a lot of work on your doodling, that you kind of, you know, especially with the unwinding that we're going to talk about later, just that idea of doodling. And I'm always doing that in lectures, or if I'm at an event or a webinar. And, you know, sometimes you'd nearly feel like you're going to get in trouble if someone catches you doing your doodling, but it's how I learn and it's how I think. And I think that's really important for teachers.
Yeah. And you kind of, it's not that you're not listening.
It's making sense of it.
Yes, I did this once in a meeting, and Rob McFarlane was sat next to me, and I was doodling away, and he was kind of nudging me like you're not paying attention. And then he realized that I was actually drawing what they were talking about, and like, right, okay.
Yeah, and I that's, it's so interesting, because I think that's a lovely way to learn. Because I always say to them, I'm not an auditory learner, but I'm a visual learner. So I'll write things down and that's how I'll understand it. Yeah. So I really wanted to talk to you today in particular about your gorgeous books, the Mrs. Noah books, as I call them. And I'm going to start off with reading this lovely little passage, because I think it'd be so nice for our listeners to actually hear kind of the magic of the words that you create. And this is from Mrs. Noah's Pockets. And it starts off with, it's raining. And it says, not the kind of rain that comes in a shower, then passes. This rain came from a sky, dark as a bruise, falling hard and fast, beating the earth, washing down tracks, making streams of pathways and rivers of roads. I just think the first time I read that, I was just entranced by it. And I'd love to talk to you about Mrs. Noah, because I feel she is kind of a character that's very unique. She's really empowering. And I think she teaches, because it's based on the kind of the story of Noah's Ark, but very, very different. And we see Mr. Noah, and he really learns a lot, I think, from Mrs. Noah, you know, her compassion and her kindness. And I'd love you to tell me a little bit about your inspiration behind that.
The books began when James was working on an opera, the Britain Opera in Tewkesbury Abbey. And I noticed that Mrs. Noah was getting very short shrift. And then I thought, actually, she doesn't get mentioned much at all, really. Must have been quite hard work being in that bar with all those animals. And she started to grow in my mind. And the whole of that phrase that you just read out came while I was walking up the hill behind my house. It was pouring with rain, and the path I was walking on had become a stream. And as I was walking, the rhythm of the language stepped into my head. It was a really strange thing. But it was the story was kind of haunting me, and I was trying to get to grips with what I wanted to say about her as a character. She very much grew. She grew in the finding of the words. She grew even more when I handed over those words to James and he began to make pictures. It's very different work from what he'd done before. He's quite well known for his Katie books, which are pen and ink. And this was a completely new language that he came up with. And just right.
They look like little collages. They're just beautiful.
Yeah. And a lot of play, a lot more play in it. And he was having quite a hard time, but I think we both fell in love with Mrs. Noah. She is a woman who, she's a rebel with a sewing machine. She goes her own way. And I think there's so much about protest, about being a rebel, that is very shouty. But she just very quietly, she looks at what needs doing and then she puts it into action. And just gets on with it, really.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I had written down here when I was reading through them, you know, that she is quietly defiant, but that she's confident. So that even that really came through to me as the reader. And I suppose you'd mentioned that you created the words before the image in your blog. And I'd love you to talk to me about those images, because when you were writing, you'd said that James contacted you, so James the illustrator, and that he had said, oh, by the way, Mrs. Noah is black. And you said that was nearly like a light bulb moment nearly for you.
Yeah, of course she is. It was just, I think that was actually, he said, oh, by the way, Mrs. Noah's black. And I went, yeah, of course she is. Yes, mm-hmm. absolutely. It's so right. Absolutely so right.
Right.
There was other things, like I said to him, oh, by the way, you know, she's got a sewing machine and it's a singer and she has an umbrella as well. And at one point he said, do you want to illustrate this book or shall I? but yes, she's a rare thing in picture books, being a woman of colour, bless mm-hmm. her heart. And in a strong position and in the front of the book. And she's the one that makes things happen.
And in front of both books, and I often talk to my students about the importance of inclusion when we're picking books for our classroom libraries, how important it is that everyone in the class feels included, that it's not this idea that it's all white characters in the storybooks, it's all middle class people in picture books, or it's, you know, that we have diversity and inclusion in our picture books. And I know there was research done in 2018 of the books that were published in that year, and I found that 50% of the characters were white, more than 20% were animals. So I suppose I felt like this book was a real breath of fresh air, and very naturally
Yeah, we had a wonderful, wonderful thing. A woman got in touch with James and said she received her book from the bookshop, must have bought it in lockdown because it was released into lockdown. A lot of publishers actually were pulling their books, and I was going, no, you can't. You have to let it go. You know, people want to read. They want new books. They don't just want everything. Anyway, this wonderful woman got in touch with James and said, we opened the book and my daughter said, oh, my word, mummy, look, it's you. Mixed race family. I think dad is white Canadian or Australian, and I can't remember where she's from now. They're a real roaming family who just wander the earth, and you know, absolutely. But how utterly delightful that she saw her mum in the book.
That's wonderful.
And then herself. Yeah,
that's lovely.
I like that.
I do as well. I just think it feels so lovely and it's so magical. And that's the word I always associate with you when I look at your books. It's the magic. Would you like to read maybe a passage? Because I've read my favorite passage. So maybe you'll read your favorite passage for me.
Well, my favorite bits of books are always the next one. And I started writing for James. This probably won't even go into the book, but I want to write about Mrs. Noah, who sings as she sows, and she sows seeds and she sows clothes. And it starts this book at the moment. It's going to really change. It seemed to the children that Mrs. Noah never slept. It was Mrs. Noah who tucked them up in bed each night, even though Mr. Noah would often read them a bedtime story. And it was Mrs. Noah who could be found out in the garden with fresh bread and bowls of bright berries for breakfast. Each night, the last thing the children would hear before they slipped into sleep was a lullaby. Each morning, as they woke into sunshine, the first thing they would hear was a song. She found music everywhere, in between the drops of gently falling rain, in the wind as it moved through the leaves, in the wings of moths, in the sound of the stream that tumbled the terraces. I read it to James the other day and he cried, so that was good.
That's a very good reaction.
It's always good. Make a grown man cry.
It is. But that's, no, I feel very lucky to have gotten a little bit of a preview to the third Mrs. Noah who might be arriving out. So I suppose we talked a little bit about, you know, grief, and I've mentioned to you that that's really my research area, that I did a lot of research on, you know, children in schools and how they cope with grief. And I know you've mentioned that, you know, this year for a lot of people has been incredibly tough. And has this, you know, the creating, has that been helpful to you? Has it been therapeutic? Have you been doing more during the coronavirus outbreak? Have you been doing, you know, what is it that helps you about it?
I wouldn't say that I've been doing more. I certainly, the last book I worked on, it's called The Lost Spells with Robert McFarlane. The last month of my working on that was worked through my father being in hospital. And then this was just before lockdown. And then he died. and I still had the cover to do. And somehow I poured everything into that cover, which is a picture of a barn owl in on a dark night. Owls in some cultures, I know in Scottish, they are messengers from the other side. They carry the souls of the dead. They carry messages between worlds. And I guess you wouldn't know by looking at it. It's one of the hardest pictures I've ever painted.
Mm.
But I have worked on books. The Seal Children, which is published by Otterbury Books, is a book about Selkies. But it's about it's partly about the space where humans and the wild meet. But it's also about those decisions about leaving loss. It has space in between the words for a child to choose to talk about grief if they wish to. I don't think it's good to keep it quiet. I think you need to talk about how you feel.
I agree with you. Often we kind of suppress it, don't we?
Yeah. And to say, you know, somebody went to sleep. So how to put the fear of God into a child?
I know. I'm actually really glad you said that, because that is one of the things that we, you know, you have to use that concrete language. And as much as it pains you to say that person has died, if you say things like sleep, every child is going to be terrified of going to sleep. Yeah. So yeah, it's so important.
And my father was a man of profound faith, and he had the great luxury of asking us if he could please die. Did we mind? And I was just thinking, you know, yeah, we all said yes. And then I was thinking, oh, you know, Dad, it doesn't happen like that. You know, you can't just. And then he switched off. It was just amazing. Mm-hmm. But he was ready to go. And it felt like, in retrospect, such a blessing. It was just before lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all of that is woven in to the lost spells. I don't know how much, when I actually come out to do talks about that, when we do events about it, how much I will be able to sit on a stage and talk about it. But I hope I can, because I think there's too much fear of death. You know, it's what we all have coming at some point. My wish is that we all make the most of life and every minute of it. And if you don't accept death as the end, then you don't use your time in the best possible way while you have it.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you. And I think I actually know the image. I've seen the cover of The Lost Spells, and I don't think I'll ever look at it the same again, because it's a really beautiful image. It really is very striking image. So thank you so much for sharing that.
Oh, it's only tiny. It's only about, it's a small book. People in the shop.
Yes, in comparison, because I have your other one here that you did, The Lost Words.
Yes.
So it's a smaller version of that, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not as big as that book.
I've got the French one. Look at that.
Oh, wow. Oh, look. Yeah. That's lovely. That's the gold, actually. There is that really lovely gold theme going through your work, isn't there? I think I associate gold with magic, and I think a lot of your illustrations have that gold going through that. Was that a conscious decision, or did it just emerge?
I've been using gold leaf for a long time. We wanted it in The Lost Words because I wanted to make of each word that icon. That's my religion. It's wild, and it's green, and it's trees, and it speaks in leaves and birds. And I wanted to make icons out of all of the images using gold leaf. I love the fairy gold that turns to leaves. My latest thing is actually typing on gold leaf with a typewriter. But that is
I've seen that on your Instagram, actually.
Yeah, it's been it's quite a lovely thing to do. I mean, you know, not everyone can get gold leaf. I'm lucky. I love to play. My latest pitch for my next project, I've honed down the words so that they would fit on 8 centimeter square of gold, and typed it and then posted it to the publisher. I think they had a bit of a shock when it arrived.
Well, I love all that creativity, because that really does come through in your books. And I was saying to you that I think especially the Mrs. Noah books, that I could really see them being used really well in a classroom when it comes to the subject of SCSE, which is the science, the geography and the history, because yeah. I think it's just beautiful, and especially the Mrs. Noah's Garden. I could imagine myself in the classroom doing a lesson about talking about planting and growing, and if you had a school garden, it would be a beautiful book to use. And I know you've worked with Eva on creating some lesson resources for the books that you've created. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I've known Eva for a long time, and she she's an educator, she's a teacher. I used to go into schools and do events with her, and she kind of taught me how to work. When you're an illustrator, author, you're expected to go into schools. You have no idea how to stand in front of a class and how to keep the attention, what to do. So Eva taught me a good deal, and actually Tell Me a Dragon grew out of things that she taught me, and I dedicated the book to her. If I spend a day in a school, the first thing I want to do when the school closes is hit the gym. I don't know how teachers do it.
Teachers are heroes.
Yeah, it's just exhausting. And
it is.
I think most people have no idea.
No idea. They often think it's a shorter day, so it must be easier. But I remember my first year of teaching, I left, when I was full-time teaching, I left every day, came home and had to have a nap.
Yes. Yeah, but also it goes on, doesn't it? It's like my work. You don't stop work and that's
it. You don't.
You're thinking about your children. You're thinking about how to stimulate one child or another child or what they need or different things, or possibly this might help that one. And it's just, But Eva works with my books to try and produce not lesson plans, but they're kind of
ideas, aren't they?
And she's worked. She did the Explorer's Notes for the Lost Words. She's doing the Lost Spells at the moment. She did Mrs. Noah for me as well, and she's also worked with the Unwinding. But not so much for schools. It's very, very open. It is a book that can be used in schools, but it's also, she's done things in there for people to do at home as well.
Can you tell me a bit more about The Unwinding? Because I'm so curious, because I know it's July it's being released, isn't it?
It is. It's
so
out today.
I'd love you to tell me.
People are getting copies delivered today and on Twitter.
Fabulous.
I've only got a copy of the silent one here, which is about halfway through the project. I had this idea to produce the book without any of the words in.
Beautiful. I've seen you doing this on your vlog, and you're it's a doodle book nearly, isn't it?
It is. It's for, so in the space where my words were, you can write your own stories if you want. Or you can draw in it, or you can basically whatever you want. This one just happens to have small pieces of gold leaf in as well.
Oh, beautiful. I'd say there's gold popping up all over your house.
Yeah, there's
actually. Secret places.
it's a book of lullabies and dreams, really. The text is slight. What you're supposed to do is read one, read two, before you go to sleep at night, as a way to take yourself out from the day and into a different space. Mm-hmm. And then you tuck it under your pillow and hopefully dream and sleep.
Lovely. I really like the idea of, you know, in a classroom, if you had maybe a child who was struggling or having difficulty even getting them to read some of those, not even, you know, for before an item, if you had them during the day in a classroom, if a child was feeling overwhelmed, I think it would be a lovely thing for them to sit and take a little bit of time out for themselves.
Yeah, but the other thing that you can do, because I maintain that pictures give access to books, that words sometimes block. Most people can read a picture, but only 75% of people can read words. And one of the beautiful things about The Lost Words is, although the words in it are quite, they're not simple words, are they? They're quite complex.
They are.
But the space around it and the images mean that reluctant readers can access that But so the idea of taking the silent unwinding and going through a few pages, so there are no words, there's no barrier. And you look at the pictures and you can make your own stories. So it's meant to ease anxiety rather than creating anxiety. I know when I was at school, we had spelling tests, which I couldn't do because I couldn't remember the shape of words. Shared reading, where you have to stand up and read, the words would jump around all over the place for me. And I didn't know that that was an unusual thing. I didn't know that that didn't happen for every person who looked at a page of text. Not until I was 42.
Oh, wow.
So it's no surprise that I struggle to read. And there are very, very simple design things that can be done to help people like me so that, you know, like having less words on a page is a good one. And it's, there's a kind of tyranny about literacy, but what I love about words, what I love about books, I love language, I love stories. And that's what kept me going with trying to learn to read. I didn't let my own failures stand in my way. So I pushed through until I cracked it and I can now read, which is good.
Wonderful. I love that because you're reminding me a little bit of my husband. My husband was, when he was four, he was told he had dyslexia, and he is so inspiring and so brilliant at everything. And I think he has learned so many talents as a result of finding really creative and adaptive ways to do things. And I just, that's when you're saying that, it's like there's a really, even the way you express yourself and the way you relate to people, that comes through in your books. And I think I see that in his way about him as well. And I think that's lovely that you share that with us. So thank you so much. I think that's a really quite inspiring, actually, to for people to hear, and that we don't kind of become, because my husband is always saying it. He's like, you know, I don't see this as a bad thing. This is a great thing. This makes me even better. You know, it makes me understand things more and explain things in a better way. So I think it's really inspiring, because often we could nearly go, oh, can't do that, I'm going to give up. It's nearly that idea of that growth mindset, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's more difficult for children these days, again, with testing, because one of the things, when you have testing, you have anxiety, and when you have anxiety, it ramps up and it struggle more. But also, where was I going with that?
I think so, just that testing is terrifying for children.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Age ranges on books. It just, you know, when I was learning to read, when I was 12, I would probably be on the 7 to 8 year old books. When you put that on the back of a book, you are really labeling a child.
I agree.
And also, why do you have to, you go from picture books, then you have chapter books, and then you have books with no pictures at all. And I don't see the sense in any of that. Why can't you, when you're 14, if you want to, read Mrs. Noah's Pockets? Why can't you find pleasure, real pleasure, in reading picture books as an adult? And, you know, there are those of us who know that you can. And then there are other people who say to their children in a bookshop, they look at Tell Me a Dragon and the child really wants it, and the parent goes, oh no, that's much too young for you, put it back, because it hasn't got many words in. And yet it has so many pictures and stories in, wrapped up in the paint.
I love that you've said that, because that's one of the things we really try to encourage with our student teachers on our program. We're always saying, you know, don't look at picture books and think these are for the early years, these are for the junior end of the school, you know, right up until, because we, you know, I work in the program that has from 4 to 12, and we're like, right up until sixth class, right up in there, you take your picture books. And I'm here with my two lovely picture books here, and that I absolutely love, and I'm 33 years of age and I still love them, and I still, we're sitting down here analyzing Mrs. Noah, being like, isn't she so compassionate? Isn't she so defiant? Isn't she so empowering? So picture books are for everyone. I completely agree. And I'm delighted with that message, because
I want to get a little bee really like Mrs. Noah badge.
Yeah, that's a really good idea. I'll buy one.
I also get upset when people take The Quiet Music of Gently Falling Snow and they go, oh, I bought it for my 4-year-old. And I think, Have you read it? Have you read the bit about the wars and the movement of people and the migration and the loss and the death?
Yeah.
Please don't give that to your 4-year old.
Yeah.
Just because it's bigger than them and full of pictures. Yeah.
So with your books, I'd love to, you mentioned The Secret of the Tattered Shoes and The House Without Windows. You might tell us a little bit about those books.
Tattered Shoes I have on hand.
Beautiful.
This story began with a desire to rewrite a very old story. It has in it a soldier. It's beautifully illustrated by Ihsan Abdullahi.
It's beautiful, yeah.
And I could never understand why this man, who, when at the end of the tasks that he has to fulfill, what you win if you get the answer right is the right to marry one of the princesses. These princesses who, for their own pleasure, have seen many men go to their deaths. Why on earth would anybody choose one of those for a bride? So I had a desire to rewrite the ending.
Brilliant.
And I also know people who are very tired of life and living. And I just wanted something that was kind of for them. There are times when everybody is weary, but when you stop and look around and you see the beautiful non-human world, you know, stop focusing on the human and all the things that we've done and just watch a bird for a while. It's something that helps me. So he finds an answer in the forest. And he returns there to try and find it again. And I did say to Ihsan, it is up to you what happens at the end. The last bit of it is he says, I've been a soldier. I've fought battles for kings until I'm weary of life and sought only death. And when I watched your daughters dance in the enchanted ballroom, so beautiful, it warmed my heart to see such love. But how that love was won and at what price made my heart sore. So many died that they might keep their secret. And so I say, I have had enough of kings and princes. I met a woman in the forest. She seemed wise and filled with life and light. She was generous to a weary stranger. I will go and see if I can find her, and I will see if she will dance with me. And then he turned and he walked away from the king and his kingdom and away from the 12 dancing princesses. And away from the castle and into a new life. And then I said to Ihsan, it's up to you what happens, whether he does or whether he doesn't find who he's
looking. And he does. That's beautiful. That's lovely.
So, yeah, strange stories. They can change. They don't always have to be the same.
Mm-hmm.
Just because that's they're written words.
That's fabulous. They're just so, there is that element, and I wrote it down whenever I think of you and I've said it, it's just that wonderful how you manage to really get that to come across in your books. It's that I feel like it's the imagination and the joy and the special fun and nature that I haven't really felt in a long time, and there hasn't been a book that has affected me quite so much, but there's something really magical and special about the books that you write. So thank you so much for sharing that with me. So I suppose we're just coming to the end of the podcast, but one thing I've been curious about, because you know The Lost Words, you, Robert McFarlane wrote that and you illustrated it, and with Mrs. Noah's Garden and Mrs. Noah's Pockets you wrote it, but James Mayhew illustrated it. Is there a reason that, I just, because I don't know, I'm just curious, is there a reason that it works that way?
There is a reason that it works that way, because with like The Unwinding, I wrote it and I illustrated it. I wrote Mrs. Noah especially for James. And that was partly because he had written a book for me called Can You See a Little Bear?
Oh, yes.
We'd had this conversation that went something like, when you're an illustrator who becomes a writer, nobody takes you seriously as a writer. And I said, okay. Well, maybe if you write something for me, and I'll illustrate it, and then I'll write something for you and you can illustrate it. Maybe people will take us more seriously. And he wrote, "Can You See a Little Bear?" And it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Really lovely to illustrate, because there's something about when you write a picture book, you have to kind of understand the space the pictures occupy. You have mm-hmm. to give that space. And because he illustrates as well, he knows how to do it. Somebody else who really knows how to do that is Nicola Davis.
Yes, I've come across her books.
Yeah, she wrote the most amazing books, The Pond and the Pond and Perfect. She knows how to leave that space. It's just astonishing. The reason I'm looking around now is because she has just illustrated her first book as well. So she's gone.
I think I've seen this on your... Oh, yes. It's about the last rhino, isn't it?
Yeah. So yes. She it's very rare that it happens the other way around, that a writer becomes an illustrator. Mm-hmm. But Nicola has. And
this is on my wish list to order. I actually saw it on Twitter and I was emailing me like, where can I buy this? Oh, yeah. Well, thank you so much, Jackie. It has been absolutely wonderful to speak to you and to hear all about your beautiful books. And I'll be sharing them with all of our students because they're fabulous. So thank you so much.
I really appreciate your time. When they're on a shelf, they're just silent and doing nothing. When they're in the hands of a good teacher, you can do so much with them. You are the people who make them come alive, really. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
I think that's what we'll definitely end with: teachers and the power of making your beautiful books come alive. Thank you, Jackie.
Thank you.